Welcome, Village.
Couple announcements before we get started here. First, this is our sign-up sheet, and if you didn't know, Easter is next week. So what we're doing a few things a little differently. Rod and I kind of have a little bit of a tradition of feeding everybody at the Village, which is fun. So we're going to have a time of eating together and remembering. And so the service is going to be about an hour long, a little shorter than our normal service. And what I need you to do to sign up is I need you to sign up if you can help set up. I need you to sign up if you can. What we're going to do with the children, because usually on Easter and Christmas and different services we have them in, this time we're going to do something with them outside of the service, but what we're going to have is a couple people rotating through, and I'll make that more clear as to what those people will be doing. But if you're interested in doing something with the kids, you can sign up for that. You can also sign up if you want to help serve food, because we're going to have everybody sat down, and then we'll bring food to people, so if you want to do that, or if you want to just help with food, you can write down on that too. And also I need some sign up for helping clean afterwards. So there's a lot of things to sign up for Easter that you can do. That would be really cool. Also, I'm supposed to say that we need to sign up for nursery and sign up for kids help. We're kind of running low on that, so if you could sign up for that, that'd be really great. And the rest of the sign up sheets, you can just sort of look through and figure out what you need to sign up for. Just pass it down rows and back up and back down. Couple things, other things to announce. If you're new with us, on that little back table, there is a couple things you can get. One, I don't have a copy of it up here, but it's a little white thing that says Village 2007-2008. It explains everything that we do. A lot of what we do is not in here because we don't meet here, so things are just a little different tonight, but you'll just have to bear with us. Also, there's this little orange booklet that has stories from the Village. Really cool. Grab that. There's also some music CDs and stuff that you can grab back there. They're all free. Go ahead and grab them if you want to do that. The other thing is, for those of you who don't at least own one of these, this is what we're preaching this week out of Nahum, which is a minor obscure prophet that you've probably never heard of. We're talking about him, but if you don't have one of these and would like one, just raise your hand. I'm going to pass them out. Anybody else? I just got a couple left. Oops, over here. Okay. Yep. I've got two left, so unless you're new, does anybody else want one? Oh, I got two left? Okay. We're talking about Nahum. Nahum, I think, is like 57 verses. I don't know. If you go to the end of the Old Testament and you count back five books, you'll find this, I believe, this obscure prophet. And most people skip this prophet because it's just so violent, and so it even stays out of many lectionaries because nobody wants to read about Nahum and the destruction that he brings. Nahum is to the Assyrians. Well, it's to the Jewish people, but it's about the Assyrians. And what the problem is, for those of you who haven't been here, I'll just kind of catch you up. The problem is that the Assyrians are these brutal, horrible, wicked people who have not just obliterated the Jewish people, they've obliterated anybody in their path. And as Ron told us, all of their art, the little art that we have, it's always about victories, and it's got spears with people's heads on it, and then there's always the royal family around that. It's just, they're into war, and they're into destroying things, and they're into taking possession of things. And so this particular book, and it's actually a book because it's an oracle, is to the Jewish people who are being oppressed by the Assyrians and crushed by the Assyrians. And it's supposed to be an encouraging book. Nahum actually means the encourager. Now, what we kind of pictured and what some commentators have suggested is that it wasn't just a book. It's kind of like propaganda. It's illegal pamphlets being passed from house to house. And, you know, people are huddled together, families and neighbors, under a candlelight reading this and thinking about maybe there's going to be some freedom. Maybe the Assyrians are actually going to be destroyed. Maybe there'll be some freedom. And so it's very violent as to what happens to these Assyrians. And so if you notice on your book, it's black and it has band stamped all over it, sort of go with that theme. But up to this point, Ron and Rod have talked to us about chapter 1. And basically what chapter 1 has told us is that God is an angry God. He gets real angry when people are not treated well. But he's slow in his reaction. He just doesn't say, ah, Joel made me angry, zap, now Joel's a smoldering bead of, you know, dust. He doesn't do that. You know, that's not how God is slow. And as he's been watching his people, because the Israelites are his chosen people, as he's been watching them, he's been getting angry. And he's been getting angry because of the injustice that's been done to them. Last week, Rod talked about really the shame that comes with oppression. Anytime that you are oppressed by something, physically, like a bully picking on you, like I remember when I lived in Globe, you hear stories from Globe because they're Globe, Miami, the armpit of Arizona, it's on the way to Roosevelt Lake. But anyway, I tell these stories a lot, but when I was like second grade to fifth grade, I lived in this Globe, Miami. My dad was vice principal of Miami High School. And, by the way, they were state champions the year he was, but anyway, in basketball. That's not important. The important thing is that there were two groups. You were either like the Cowboys or the Cholos, right? And the Cholos had the cars that go up and down, and the Cowboys had the hats that were way too big and the boots that looked kind of funny. And so, but I was kind of the odd kid out a lot, and so I remember always walking with my head down because I figured if you don't look at people who don't like you, they won't hurt you. And, you know, if you can just like avoid them somehow. And I did a lot of trying to disappear in crowds and disappear when, you know, people called attention to you. You just sort of try to disappear somehow. Well, Rod talked a lot about that's how we feel when we're oppressed by somebody. And so we have our heads down. And what this passage, this verse at the very end of chapter 1 of Nahum said, the very first thing is verse 15 of chapter 1 says, look up, because there's going to be someone who's bringing good tidings and who's proclaiming peace. And so Rod talked a lot about this idea that we needed to look up because our peace and our victory in life is coming. And he was saying that was coming with Jesus. Tonight, what I'd like to say to you is simply this. I am not oppressed. I am not a person who is oppressed, but I live with my oppressors. That's all of you. No, just joking. Just joking. I'm not oppressed, but I live with my oppressors. That, I want to flesh that out for you a little bit, but before we get there, I want you to read Nahum through this lens. Assyria is an oppressor. But I want you to see Assyria as sin. Because sin is an oppressor. I want you to see the Israelites, the Jewish people, I want you to see them as you, as a human. And so when we talk about oppression, I want you to think about sin oppressing you. Sin oppressing you. Because as humans, sin oppresses us. Now, what is sin? Well, sin literally in the Greek means missing the mark. It's an archery term. So when you shoot the arrow, you miss it. And I can guarantee you I am oppressed and I miss the mark, or I live with this sin. This week it's come to light in my life even more. My wife has been sick for 2 weeks, and she really was into planning Hannah's shower. And when my wife gets to planning things, she forgets about me. And when she forgets about me, I start getting really angry. Only thing is, I have this other sin issue in my life, is that my wife doesn't do any wrong. Now, she does a few things wrong, but so somehow she and I have created this thing that everyone else is the enemy, so we're okay. So what I realize is, in this 2 weeks, I start getting angry at everybody. I'm just angry. I'm angry at the people who live in my house. I'm angry at the kids. I'm angry at all the people who are coming in and out of my house. I'm angry at you guys. I'm angry at people at the grocery store, the car that cuts me off. I was just angry. Now, if you're around the village long enough, then you know that what we say is that unless you see someone being treated unjustly, and you get angry, that's an okay anger. If I'm wailing on Keith and his hands are tied behind his back, because you need to be for me to be able to wail on him, and you got mad at me, that's an okay anger. But mostly what anger is you want people to do things and they're not doing them. You want people to like you. You want people to not cut you off. You want people to be nice. You want people to be thoughtful. You want people to stop being stupid. You have all these things, and those are great longings. Even not wanting people to be stupid, it's okay to not want people to actually, think. But when you start demanding that people do that and getting mad when they don't, that's sin. And so I'm oppressed by this anger that I just realized that, it was my wife I was supposed to be angry at. That's a whole other subject. But anyway, just to say that we as people are oppressed. I could list off all the things that I worry too much. I've told you, I've struggled with lying and exaggerating. Any of you could stand up here and say, probably, well, these are the things that I struggle with, but it might be too embarrassing to do that. But you could, and you would say, yeah, I have what I would call an oppressor sin. So, if you can think of Assyria as the oppressor, sin, and you as the Israelites, I would like to reread verse 1:15, and then we'll go into chapter 2, because I don't think I can talk about chapter 2 without really talking about this verse. So, I want to go back to 15. It says, "Look on the mountains, the feet of one who brings good tidings, who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, O Judah, fulfill your vows, for never again shall the wicked invade you. They are utterly cut off." Well, this message, if we look at this through the lens of sin being an oppressor, and we hear this, it's the gospel in its very basic extent. The gospel is that you and I are corrupted by sin, and Paul tells us in Romans, that the wages of sin is death. And what he's talking about is physical death and spiritual death. But literally what he means is that you are cut off from God. And so Christ, God himself, comes on the cross, and this is what we're looking forward to here, Good Friday and Easter, and dies for our sins. He pays the price, all that sin is put on him, all your sin. Instead of you dying, he dies, and he raises from the dead. And Hebrews tells us that death brings us anxiety. Because Christ rose from the dead, we don't need to be anxious about God, about our life with God after we die, because God has reached his eternal hand down to us to grab a hold of ours if we want it. Well, that's what this is saying, because it's saying the feet of one, a runner is coming who's bringing good news. Good news, good tidings. It means victories. So what he's saying is, someone, look to the mountains, because someone's coming who's saying, hey, the Syrians are defeated, and who is proclaiming peace. Now, most of you who would say, hey, I'm a follower of Jesus, would say that you still have trouble with sin. You still struggle with doing the right thing, or feeling good about yourself, or seeing God as somebody who's actually making things right. Well, this is what these Jewish people are saying. They're saying, they have this little book and they're looking over it, and it's saying, wait a minute, there's victory and peace? Well, what is, because it's really interesting here, is that he asks them to do something before the victory and peace actually comes. And that is to celebrate your festivals and fulfill your vows. So you have to do two things. When the announcement, which this book is the basic announcement, the Assyrians are dying, it's all over, you're going to be liberated. Now start celebrating your festivals and participating in your vows. Well, just to kind of connect this to our life now as followers of Jesus, you look at 2 Corinthians, and I'll just go there for you, chapter 5, my favorite verse, verse 17, Paul, a writer and an apostle, is writing to some churches he planted. He says, verse 17, therefore, if anyone is in Christ, the new creation has come, the old is gone, the new is here. Literally in the Greek, it says that the new has come and is coming, the old has gone and is going. And so what the gospel is about is when you become a follower of Jesus, God says you're a new creature and you are in the process of becoming new. And the old is no longer you, it's gone, but it's in the process of going. Well, this is where these Israelites are. Nahum is saying the Assyrians are on their way out. Now you need to start being an Israelite. Now this is why this is really, really important. Assyrians were masters of one thing, and that was destroying the identity of a nation. What they would do is they would come to a big place and a big city, and they would say, look, here's the deal, guys. We could put your heads on spikes, like these two guys we have here on spikes, or you could let us take you over, and after a little bit, we'll exile all of you, and you could be slaves, but we'll treat you to the life you're at now. And so most people are like, okay, well, why did they do that? Well, they stripped any kind of identity away from the people so that they had no way of really being interconnected. And so what is Nahum saying? Nahum is saying, start living in your identity that's about to come. Well, this is what the gospel says to us. This is what God says. You are a new creature, now start living like a new creature as you become one. And so I think there's some clues in this passage about how to do that. So first, celebrating your festivals. Well, here's the Jewish festivals. The first one is Sabbath. Sabbath, this is actually a festival. What is Sabbath? It's rest. I looked up rest in the dictionary, and it says to stop, to sleep, to do a whole bunch of labor and then stop doing labor. And what the Hebrew people were doing was every week, one day, they rested. Now, why were they supposed to rest? Well, they were supposed to rest so they could reflect on the last 6 days and what God had done and what they had done. So the first part probably of what you and I should do as followers of Jesus, if we're going to take the Israelites as an example, is that if you're a follower of Jesus, you should rest. The question you have to ask yourself is, am I resting? Because part of being a new creature is being someone who isn't driven by the values of your culture and the values of what's good and in culture and what makes you important, because rest really isn't part of it. You know, we are the hardest working people in the world. Are we not the hardest? We just work the longest. I'm not so sure we're the hardest. But anyway, we don't rest much. So the first part is being resting. Well, the other parts of the festival basically break down like this. There's a celebration of harvest, of what God has provided. You know, so we throw a big party and we share the first part of harvest together. The other one is to celebrate what God has done historically with us. So to celebrate his deliverance, the other festivals they celebrate is his protection, and the other one is his faithfulness. So part of being an Israelite is to stop and remember what God has done. Now what's really interesting about Israelites is that they're not individualistic people. See, the reason how they're an Israelite is that they're part of Israel. They don't see themselves as an individual, and then as an Israelite they see it the other way around. And so all of their remembering happens together. And then they do that individually. And so I think part of what you and I have to do, if we're going to grab onto our new creatureness, and you can read Julie's blog on the internet because it talks about this, but we have to rest and remember together. We've done that as a community, but part of it is grabbing hold of what God has done in our lives and then calling everybody else to celebrate and remember what God has done in theirs, and to celebrate what God is doing in theirs, yours. One good example is, I remember when Cheryl threw a great big party because she had stopped smoking for an entire year. So she threw a big old party, and we all came, and she invited all her friends, and we celebrated that she stopped smoking. We remembered what God had done in that year with her. I remember when Russ and Emily got married, or not, when they got engaged, we threw the Festival of Love. And we went through neighborhoods and grocery stores, and we invited people to a party for two people getting engaged, who'd waited a really long time to get engaged. And these people are like, who are these people? I don't know who these people are. Well, like 150 people came to a party. Half of them didn't even know who was being celebrated. But we were remembering what God had done. And there's lots of other examples in our community of how that works. So we have to do that as a community, but we also have to do that on an individual level. And I think that's the more difficult part, is to actually stop and find out what God has done in your life and to remember. Because, you know, a lot of times I talk to people and it's like, well, I don't know how, like, what kind of, like, how God speaks to me, and I don't feel close to God, and those are all valid. The part of it is because you haven't sat down and taken the time to look at your life and ask the question, okay, well, where did Jesus actually show up? And so one very good exercise that I would suggest you do at least once or twice a year is sit down and tell somebody your entire life story and how Jesus showed up in that. And let them ask how Jesus showed up in that. And what he did, and what kind of struggles you went through, and what you learned, because you will begin to see that God actually interacts in your life, and you'll begin to get a better ear for his voice and a better eye for his action in your life. And then you can actually throw bigger parties because you can articulate better what he's doing. So I would suggest that be something we do as a community. But if you just want a starting point, I would say that you actually rest once every week. That you actually just take a few hours to stop. Don't turn on the TV, don't turn on your, you know, computer, don't go call your friends. Just sit. If you're a mom and you have kids who are crazy, I don't know, lock the bathroom door for, you know, an hour and make your husband go take the kids. Or your next door neighbor, or whoever. But take some time to stop and say, okay, God, what did you do this week? And think through your days and write it down. And then when you write it down, go tell people. The next thing that we need to do, it says here, at least he's asking these people to reclaim their identity, is to fulfill their vows. Well, really, it's to get back into the religious system that the Israelites had. So if the Assyrians ripped these people away from their land and their festivals, and you find out, if you look at the history and you read the Old Testament, you find out that these Israelite kings and people began to sacrifice their children, because that's what the Assyrians did, and that's what the Assyrian gods called for. And if you, this is something that not just Christians and Jewish people say, but historians in general will tell you, that the Jewish religion was a faith that put a stop to child sacrifice. It was the one religion in history, major religion, that said, no, we're not going to kill our kids to worship God. That's not going to be part of the agenda. It was a sacred, like a one that actually had a way of connecting people together. And so what he's saying here is that you need to begin to practice your spiritual identity. You need to get back to doing animal sacrifice for your sin. You need to celebrate your festivals. You need to get back into this faith, because that's part of your identity. Well, that's part, if you're a follower of Jesus, part of being a new creature. Paul tells us in Romans 12:1, as all of you can probably quote, because we sing it over and over again, that it's, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercies, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and acceptable, blah, blah, blah. I can't always quote it very well. But the point of 12:1 is that you and I have become the spiritual sacrifice, that we offer ourselves to God. Well, how do you offer yourself as a sacrifice to God? How do you even figure that out? Like, what does that look like? Do you say, God, I'm yours, do anything you want with me? What does that mean? Well, I'll tell you what it means. The way you can know is ask yourself this. If you're married, it's, how am I sacrificing myself for my kids? How am I offering myself to the kids and not expecting anything back? How am I offering myself to my spouse and not expecting anything back? If you're not married, or you are married, you can still ask the question, how am I offering myself to my friends, my roommates, my workmates, my neighbors? How am I offering myself and not expecting anything in return? Because most of us, and I do this all the time, and again, read Julie's blog because she talks about this. I didn't know she was going to talk about this, but it's important. It's that most of us like to sacrifice ourselves for the good feeling that we get. You know, this is good liberalism. I feel good about myself because I'm helping people. Now, we won't even talk about the conservatives and their ideas of helping people, but that's liberalism, and that's kind of how our country has worked. And that's how we work as individuals. I offer myself to Ruth because when she smiles and hugs me and is so excited about what I've done, I feel good. It's very hard for me just to say, I'm going to offer myself to Ruth because I love Ruth and I want to see her grow towards God. So the question that you can ask yourself, you can begin to ask yourself, is where are the areas in my life where I'm offering myself to get something, or I just don't want to offer myself at all? Part of stepping into being a new creature in Christ is to begin to offer yourself, because that's part of our faith. Christ offered himself for us. We offer ourselves to the people around us, and this is our way of being followers of Jesus. And the cool thing, at the very last part of this verse, it says, "For never again shall the wicked invade you. They are utterly cut off." The message to the Hebrew people is, you will no longer lose your identity. No one's going to come rip it away from you. You will have some semblance of your identity as an Israelite. Ta-da. And as a Christian, when Christ died on the cross and rose from the dead, what he says to you when he offers you life is, you no longer have to walk around like a dead person. You're not a walking dead person anymore. You can actually have a relationship with God. You are now actually human. Because if you read the Gospel of John, and you hear me say this all the time, you find out in the Gospel of John that basically Jesus is like, you're all walking dead people. But if you'll accept what I have to offer, you can actually be human. You can regain your humanness, because right, sin has stripped us from being human. It's just turned us into really evil people. All you have to do is look at the news to figure that one out. So, I say that because we want to jump into chapter 2. And I want you have an idea of how you can offer yourself, how you can step into this identity. But I want to talk just a little bit more about Good Friday and Easter, and I'm going to tie it into Nahum. Because see, let me just read for you verse 1 and 2 of chapter 2 of Nahum. And this is what he says to the Israelites. And he's kind of, this is God sort of mocking the Assyrians. He says, "A shatterer has come up against you. Guard the ramparts." He's kind of saying this mockingly. "Oh, quick, do as much as you can. Guard the ramparts. Watch the road. Gird your loins. Collect your strength. Ha, ha, ha. You're not going to be able to do this." And then he says, "For the Lord is restoring the majesty of Jacob as well as the majesty of Israel, though ravagers have ravaged them and ruined their branches." I love this picture because what it says, God is coming like a shatterer against the Assyrians, who are these really powerful people. When I think about that, it's just a picture of how God comes against sin, how Jesus came against sin. And when I was just thinking about this picture, I remember going through Matthew when we preached, and the description of Christ's death really reminded me of the shatterer. If you can imagine, like, it's like just taking when you see the swordsman, it's like two swords just like slamming really hard, and you just see all the sparks fly. Well, this is what happens when God and sin crash together. In Matthew 27, we have Jesus' death. He's on the cross, he's been beaten, he's been scourged, put on the cross. And in verse 50, says this, "And then Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, and he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn from top to bottom." This is the curtain in the temple that was in Jerusalem that divided the Holy of Holies from humans. And it's this really thick cloth and that you could never rip, and it's just ripped. So the first action we hear is just like this gigantic curtain is just torn. "The earth shook, rocks split, and tombs broke open. The bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs after Jesus' resurrection and went to the holy city and appeared to many people." that's just kind of a funny verse. Can you imagine that? You're sleeping there, and then mom shows up next to you and says, "Hi, how are you?" And you're like, "Oh, hi. You've been dead for a while." That's got to be a weird experience. But it was so crazy. God dying and raising from the dead, it shook the order of things. And that's what we're looking at on Friday, Good Friday. We are looking at the death of God, Christ, fully man, fully God, shattering everything. This death, like, tore curtains. The earth quaked. And then in chapter 28, Jesus has been dead for 3 days, and chapter 28 starts out this way. After the Sabbath at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. But you would if you saw an angel. Again, the resurrection then is represented in Matthew by this angel, and the earth shakes. And so when I read Nahum and I think about what he's saying about the Assyrians were powerful, powerful, powerful. This is like Russia and America combined at their height of power coming against you. These are the Assyrians. And God's like, "I'm going to shatter you." And this is what God does to sin, is he shatters it in his death and his resurrection. And what I love about verse 2 then is it says, in Nahum it says, that he's going to restore the majesty of people basically who are empty and dead. A nation that is empty and dead. And literally what he's saying is a nation that's been emptied of all its wealth and all of its identity, and its branches are dead. Anything that's any worthwhile in it, just gone. But God is going to restore its majesty. Well, that's what sin did to you. It ripped away your majesty, your glory, your humanness. And so this message is not just to these Israelites. I'm going to restore all 12 tribes to their majesty and their glory of Solomon, probably. He's saying, I'm going to restore you, your majesty, your glory, your honor. I'm going to make you human if you'll become a follower of me. I'm going to shatter that. I think that's really, really cool. It's just an exciting thing. Well, that's what we're celebrating in Easter, that you and I actually get to be the process of having our majesty restored. That's exciting. It's worth a party, and that's what we're celebrating. Verse 3 says this, the shields of his warriors, and this is talking about the Babylonians and the Medes, they're about to come against the Assyrians, and says, the shields of his warriors are red, his soldiers are clothed in crimson, the metal of the chariot splashes on the day when he musters in. The chargers prance, the chariots race madly through the streets, they rush to and fro through the squares, their appearance is like torches, they dart like lightning. Well, if you're a Jewish person and you're sitting with your candle, with your family, and you're reading this stuff, you're going, God's just a little wacky, because I know the Assyrians, and they ain't going to do anything. They're not going to be destroyed. I'm oppressed. I've lost everything. I've lost my son to a sacrifice. I'm not in a good place. This guy's crazy. Well, you know what? Sometimes I feel that way living in this world about sin. I think, Jesus, you died on the cross and rose from the dead to save me, but you know what? This life ain't that hot. It isn't that good. And then I listen to your stories, and I listen to my own story, and I think, whoa, God, there's a lot of crap going on and a lot of damage. And I'm not so sure about this new human, new majesty thing that you're talking about. And what we lose sight of is God's power to do anything. And so, in this little part here, I think, and well, all four verses here, but in particular 3 and 4, Nahum, God through Nahum, is saying, let me just tell you about the Babylonians. You think the Assyrians are powerful? Well, let me tell you about the Babylonians and Medes. They got these chariots, and they're going to kick some hiney, and they're going to be flashing all over the place, and you know, the Assyrians are just going to be wiped out. But what God is saying is, I'm strong. I can do it. I am capable. And so when you and I are in the midst of trying to learn to celebrate and rest and reflect, when we're trying to figure out what it means to offer ourselves as living sacrifices, as we wrestle not with being oppressed, but with our oppressor, with them leaving, watching them, trying to kick them out the door, our worry, our anger, what the mean things people say to us, the oppression and bad things of our culture that hit us. What God is saying to you is, I'm powerful and I will do what I'm going to do. I will make you whole. It might take you a little bit longer than you want. They had to wait, after this book was written, 40 more years for the Assyrians. And Ron said when he opened this book, is if you learn anything from Nahum, you learn that when God says something, that he's going to do something, he wants you to learn to wait. Because he's not a God who says, I'm going to do this, and then tomorrow he does it. He waits. And he always is in the process of teaching us patience. But he does do it. And 40 years later, after this book was written, the Assyrians are so wiped out that not until recently have we actually even got any idea of what Nineveh, their capital city, is like, and what they believed and how they operated, in particular Nineveh itself, which is this is all about. So God is saying to us, I am strong. So we have to be reminded. We have to read. That's why we write things down. That's why we write, this is what God has done in my life. This is what he did this week, this lifetime. This is why the Israelites celebrated God delivering them in the desert, because he wants us to remember that he did do something, and that he's strong, and that he's powerful. And just to continue a little bit here, because here's where God, and it's kind of violently, has his own sense of humor with Nahum. They're kind of making fun of the Ninevites. He calls his officers, this is speaking of the king. They stumble as they come forward. It's sort of like the Three Stooges. You know, they're bonking each other in the eye. Oh, yeah, we got it, somebody's coming. They hasten to the wall, and the mantle is set up. The river gates are open. The palace trembles. It's decreed that the city be exiled, the slave women led away, moaning like doves and beating their breasts. Nineveh is like a pool whose waters run away. Halt, halt! But no one turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. There is no end of treasure and abundance of every precious thing. Devastation, desolation, and destruction. Hearts faint and knees tremble. All lions quake. All faces grow pale. God basically says, let me tell you, I am going to wipe out the Assyrians. I am going to wipe out sin so matter-of-factly that the treasures of the world, the treasures of the Assyrians, you can walk in and pick it up. Nobody's going to stop you, because they'll be gone. So tonight, what I want you to think, and what I want you to think about this week, is what's happening next week. What we are remembering, because there's not a lot of festivals in Christianity, but Easter and Good Friday are big. And what we're remembering together is that God died, that he shattered sin in his death and then in his resurrection that we celebrate on Sunday. And so what I'd like you to do is to say, in response to that, if I can follow Jesus, if I actually believe he was God and he died on the cross and rose from the dead, if I can actually believe that, and if you don't have to, you can wrestle with that for as long as you want, but if I believe that, what's my response? How do I celebrate? How do I step in to renewing my vows, to sacrificing? What does that look like? It's a big word at the village, but it's a good one. What does it look like? What would I do? That's what I want you to answer. We have just 2 or 3 minutes for questions. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask me before we close? The treasures of in Assyria?
Well,
or treasures of...
In the analogy?
In the analogy? Well, I think the treasures, because sin has been destroyed, is that you get to understand and taste what's good. And that you can begin to actually look at yourself and see what God has actually created you to be and act in that. So I think that would be our human treasures. Now, anyway. Anybody else have any questions? Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much. Anybody else have any other questions before we close? A few minutes? All right. Let's close in prayer. Dearest God in heaven, we thank you so much just for loving us and for loving us where we're at, not expecting that we get it all right, Lord, as we journey together with you and with one another, I just pray that you would give us the courage to believe things that are true when we hear them and they're true, and the courage to question when we don't understand. And Lord, tonight, for the rest of this evening, as we sing and as we sit quietly together, as we give our offerings, we ask that you would be amongst us, and we know you are. And we ask this in your name, Jesus. Amen. Tonight, there is a couple ways that you can respond to God's word. One is through offering. If you're visiting with us, we're just happy to have you. We don't expect you to give anything. You can just pass the basket all the way to the back and put it under the last chair. I'd appreciate that.